Adrian, welcome to Cease and Desist Podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
And it's great to be here.
So we've just been catching up before we spoke, and it's often that the where do we start with any sort of guest? And sometimes people have a book they want to talk about. Sometimes there's an initiative someone wants to talk about. And I'm really sort of excited to have you on the show because we've had because we've had a hugely, like, ridiculously diverse range of, you know, of speakers, people from the DOJ, IRSCI, people from the White House. And but actually, that this is great for me because it's sort of bringing it, you know, back home as a, you know, lowly sort of criminal investigator in revenue and customs. I'd always looked up at the enormous NCA. I'd worked with people at the NCA. And then I remember when I was the sort of seized asset manager in the UK, you know, hearing about the NEC and sort of this creation of this new entity. So you've just, you know, made the transition out of the public sector into the private sector. Yep. But your most recent posting was the NEC. And I would love to start there, if you don't mind. And what got you into that position in the NEC? And what is the NEC for those people that work in asset recovery in the UK? For those that don't know, of course.
Okay, so I'll start with what the NEC is, and I can then explain how I ended up there. But it's a relatively unique entity. I'm not sure it's quite replicated anywhere else in the world. But the sort of headline is it's a multi-agency unit housed in the NCA, which aims to bring together the collective efforts of law enforcement, the relevant bits of government, relevant regulators, and as appropriate, the private sector. And it wants to bring together the efforts of those different organisations and sectors to maximise collective impact on the threat. I think when it was established back in 2018, there was a recognition that the NCA itself, which had at that point an economic crime directorate, couldn't solve everything by itself. And actually, these problems were that we were facing were multifaceted, and you needed to bring all the bits of the system, a bit of a clunky word, but you know, bring the system together to better impact the threat. And the NEC was created to help do that. And when I was there, I was wearing basically three hats. I was the director of the NEC. I was also the director with overall responsibility for the UK Financial Intelligence Unit. And then I was also a director within the National Crime Agency itself. And then to give you a sense of the sorts of folk we had in the NEC and the organisations they were from, you know, it was wide ranging. So we had people from HMRC, our Revenue and Customs, from City of London Police, who've got a key role as what's called the lead force for fraud and a key force for overseeing economic crime work more generally in policing. We had reps from the likes of the Financial Conduct Authority, the key regulator. More recently, we had someone join us from Ofcom as we try to reorientate a bit more towards the sort of telco and tech sectors. We had people in from the banks, from the pensions regulator, you know, from lots of different organisations to try and better understand, you know, the drivers of those organisations and then, say, bring a collective effort together more comprehensively. In terms of how I ended up there, my career history is a bit of a sort of a strange zigzag, but I think ultimately it sort of probably made sense where I ended up. So I spent very little bit of time in banking initially as a graduate, then a few years in the army, then slightly randomly made TV documentaries for a few years. But then I moved into sort of central government. I was for nearly sort of 19, 20 years working in a variety of defence and security related roles. And then latterly in my sort of time in that space, I was involved with the creation of the National Cybersecurity Centre. And I was asked by Kieran Martin, the chief exec, a few sort of months into it to come across from where I was and actually take over the incident management function. So when there's a big national scale or nationally significant cyber incident, it was me and my team who helped oversee the response to that. And that involved bringing together lots of different bits of government, but also the private sector, whether it be the private sector as potentially a victim of the incident, or more often it was the private sector that we called on to help with resourcing the response to the incident.
Just out of my own interest, because that's such an interesting role. What triggered sort of national incident? Could it be a very large private sector impact that could be like UK, because it's a telecoms provider or something like that? What was that criteria for a major incident?
I mean, it's something that we actually developed while I was there, which was a sort of incident prioritization schema to try and help determine, you know, what requires what sort
was
of
an incident
of response. Primarily what we were looking at was it a key bit of government that was being impacted, or was it a key bit of the critical national infrastructure, which obviously would have the broader ramifications. If one of those
it could be a private company, but it's a private company that works with the NHS, or it's a private company that works with it. I got you.
Yeah. And so, you know, we'd have to sort of determine what could this impact look like in reality in terms of numbers of people impacted, costs involved, impact on sort of national delivery of stuff. So, there's a schema for it, and I think it's still used today in terms of determining.
The reason I ask is that one of the big challenges around asset recovery is that how do you coordinate everything together? And there is this blend of public and private sector, conflicting priorities, and how do you develop standardization? So, yeah, that's set you up perfectly for the next stage of your career in asset recovery and economic crime.
Well, that was the thing. So I think because I had that experience working across sectors, as it were, from a cybersecurity perspective, I then actually left government. That was my sort of bridge into the private sector. And I left and joined what was Royal Bank of Scotland when I started, and was NatWest Bank formerly when I left. And I was head of security and data risk for the bank. So I was like an advisor to the board, critical friend to the CISO, the chief information security officer. And so that gave me a good understanding of the challenges, opportunities for UK banks. And so when I was asked whether I'd throw my hat in the ring for the NEC role, I assume I was asked because I had that blend of private sector experience, government experience, understood cybersecurity, and obviously cyber is a key component of the threat now. Also in the prior defence security stuff I was doing, I was very much involved in sort of proactive intelligence work, and that was a key ambition to try and shift the economic crime response into a more proactive space. So I think it was that blend of skills and experience that made me an attractive candidate for the director role.
And we should also say, forgive me, to our international audience, NEC is the National Economic Crime Center.
There will be lots of these acronyms, so please pick me up if I don't use. Explain what they are.
I'm the most guilty for it, and that was one of the reasons why I was so keen to speak to you. Obviously, our paths have crossed at RUSI, the think tank. But one of the things for me was that asset recovery is a global sort of problem, and I'm talking about the sector versus the actions of seizing assets. And the very fact that asset recovery doesn't have a global definition, I think sort of therein lies some of the problem that I would love to hear your thoughts on. But that was one of the reasons that interested me to having this conversation, because the only way we can come up with some sort of solution is looking at different models of whether it's collaboration, whether it's accountability, whether it's multi-stakeholder engagement, and all of the various sort of terms and buzzwords. But unless you can actually bring it all together and do something, I think that's what every country, certainly the ones that we work with, are sort of crying out for. What have they done over there? What have you seen that has worked? What was, and just to drill back a little bit on the three hats role that you were at the NEC, the FIU, and then a director in the NCA more generally. How would that, to a country that doesn't have a NEC-style function, as you said, it's quite rare, what would you say are the differentiators of someone saying, okay, you have maybe an asset recovery unit that sits and has some of the functionality, like a country like Jamaica, for example, there's a designated asset recovery unit, or they have within their version of CPS, they have assigned individuals responsible for the prosecution. And then everyone kind of knows where a traditional FIU fits in, receiving that first bit of intel, making that dissemination, doing reactive and proactive. What for you was the key differentiator of the need? Was this UK specific as a financial center, we just needed it? Or is it something that you think that actually smaller jurisdictions could borrow from that playbook? And it doesn't have to be a 50 people, 100 people, 200 people. It could just be a couple of people in a role. So I would love to hear what you think about how it works and the advantages or disadvantages to rolling it out. And also let us know how many people were in the NEC. Is this a 330 or 113 sort of size organization?
Yeah, in terms of the NEC and numbers, just to pick up that last question, it's now around about the sort of 100 figure. Mm-hmm. But to say a lot of those are people who are actually seconded in, as opposed to necessarily being NCA
new style. Hires.
And then it's all about force multiplier effect, because you have people representing different organizations that they can then reach back and you know, draw on resources from those organizations. I mean, I guess as you were intimating, as you were asking the question, that there's lots of different shapes and sizes of and different approaches in different countries. And the UK being, you know, a big financial centre, it has a certain particular approach, but smaller countries, you know, it'll be a different model. Similarly for FIUs, as you'll know, they're very different in different countries. Sometimes they sit as part of a central bank, sometimes they're housed in law enforcement, and it clearly varies. I think for the UK, there was just a recognition that we have so many key stakeholders that need to be brought together to drive a response, that couldn't necessarily come solely out of an FIU function. It needed something else. Also, it's probably worth touching on the fact that prior to the creation of the NEC, so the National Economic Crime Centre, there was also, to throw out another acronym, there was also GIMLIT, so the Joint Money Laundering Intelligence Task Force. And that was already housed in the National Crime Agency. And that was already, I think, just hit its 10-year anniversary. That was already playing a role more at a sort of tactical operational level in terms of acting as an intermediary between law enforcement and, in particular, the banks. So there's something unique in the UK, I think, relatively unique, around the legislative framing for the National Crime Agency itself, and something in the Crime and Courts Act called Section 7, which is sort of a permissive data sharing sort of regime, which means that law enforcement can share, you know, request into the private sector, and the private sector can share back, and there's sort of legal cover for doing so. So I think that immediately, again, puts the NCA and you know, what we're trying to do with the FIU, and then ultimately evolve GIMLET into the NEC. It gives us a slightly unique position, perhaps, compared to other countries.
Yeah, because that was always one of the challenges I hear countries talking about, was even if you have, and obviously this is now morphing into crypto, but fundamentally you could argue that what a bank is doing and what a VASP is doing is similar in the sense of the potential role they can play as a stakeholder to, you know, receive requests and sort of transmit information. And in other jurisdictions, you don't have that legal cover or protection for information sharing, which means that the requests are very traditional. They're very slow analog requests. It's here's a production order, argue about it for 2 or 3 months. Maybe it takes 6 months, 9 months to get information back. And then there's more stuff we want to ask for, need a new order for that. And all of a sudden, I can even recall from my days in law enforcement, it's sort of working, like I wasn't in our RIS team or any of those teams, but even just being anecdotally aware, this is, I mean, in within the UK, I used to regularly get, made fun of by my law enforcement colleagues. Cause like, oh, there's the guy from HMRC. When we want information out of you, it takes 18 months. You need like a gateway request just to ask for information on someone's tax returns. I mean, you've probably seen better than anybody the challenges of sharing information globally from an asset recovery perspective. Was it that sort of Section 7, that piece of legislation? Is that the sort of missing piece? Because I imagine there's no point in having a GIMLET or a NEC or a public and private sector collaboration in any country if you don't do the fundamental, like if you don't crack information sharing back and forward. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, and you know, the reality is it's hard enough domestically before you get to international.
Interagency, yeah.
So I think in the UK, at least over the last 10 years or so, we've been really focused on how can we improve domestic data sharing. And there's no doubt Section 7, the GIMLET construct on which the NEC was then built, you know, have been fundamental to certainly the sort of public-private partnership working and how that's evolved over the last, say, decade. And I think it would be key for other countries to try and replicate some kind of, you know, legislative framing that enables that flow between the public and private sectors. I mean, I suspect we'll get on to sort of the international challenges perhaps later in the conversation, rather than me leapfrogging to them now. But
feel free. We're on a logical curve and conversation. I'll drag us back anyway. But if we stick with that theme, if you'd like to, with sort of international sharing, please, you have a. You have a green light.
I mean, what I might do is actually myself take us back to domestic, because I think we almost need to understand how the domestic has evolved, which then can inform how the international hopefully will evolve in future as well. But domestically, as I said before, GIMLET was a relatively tactical construct. A particular scene of investigation.
But give people an example of what Gimlet is. Like in real terms, it is, you know, people from the banks like sitting around. I imagine some people who haven't heard of it will think, is it a brand new agency created? Is it a new department? Like what did Gimlet look like practically?
So it's now a sort of sub team of the NEC. So at its heart, a law enforcement investigator will want to seek some extra information from particular banks, but it can be beyond that now, to help them further their investigation. So they put a request in to Gimlet. Gimlet then packages it up in the right way and then sends it out to the relevant bank or banks. They then do the work their end and they pass the information back in. And Gimlet's a sort of intermediary function, albeit it's also a sort of standardization function and ensures that the requests and the responses come together coherently. But as I say, that's relatively tactical approach. And although it remains highly effective, and I was just looking at the stats for last year, and as a result of some Gimlet activity, because Gimlet as a subset still exists, there were 900 new accounts associated with criminality identified, 66 million in assets restrained in some way as a result of that exchange. So still really important. But what we recognised was that's, as I say, relatively tactical, and we sort of need to build on that and really enhance the public-private work and to take it into a more strategic space.
That then was Gimlet proactively, would that be then, just again to follow the thread, was the work of Gimlet proactively identifying those assets, then that would form the part of some sort of SAR, some sort of disclosure? Was there additional work going on to identify it and sort of collaborate, or was it always driven? Was it always law enforcement request driven, saying, "Hey, we're looking at this individual. We need help with this."
I think there's no doubt. If a bank receives a request by a Gimlet, they themselves will start to look at their own, their own information. That may in turn trigger internal investigations, and they may then determine that they need to issue SARs, etc. So, often it's a relatively iterative. Albeit one of the big complaints I often heard from partners in banking was it felt, whether it's through the Gimlet model or also through the whole SARS regime, the relationship with law enforcement felt very one-sided or one way. The information goes in and then you don't really hear very much. And that's one of the things I've been very keen to try and address, or I was very keen to try and address in my role as Director NEC. And that's sort of, I guess, is a bit of a segue into, so how did we try and do things differently, or certainly how do we try to evolve the work of Gimlet? And so for me, when I describe the work of the NEC, I use three sort of words to describe it. It was understand, direct, and enhance. So and all of this was working with partners, but we sought to understand the economic crime threat. We then, based on that understanding, sought to direct at a strategic level the system's operational response to it. So that's sort of directing certain bits of high level sort of framing for operational activity across the system. And sorry, it's a really clunky word, that system, but it's all those bits that need to come together.
It's true, yeah.
And then lastly, often drawing from the understanding we've got from the operational experiences we have with our partners, then ideas as to how we enhance that overall response. And that enhancement could be legislative change that's required, and every year, as director of the NEC, I would write a letter to my direct counterpart in the Home Office suggesting things that I think that could change in legislation that would really help the response to the threat. And we'd also sort of innovate and pilot and try stuff. And I think the clearest example of that I can give you is the work that we've been doing for some time, the NEC have been doing for some time on data fusion. And I might just flesh that out a little bit, just to give people a sense of it. Yep. So I think it helps.
Because I'd actually taken notes to say that it was one of the things that we talked about in a previous episode with Jared Koopman from IRSCI, talking about how do you deal with all of the different analytic companies that have all this potential data, because they were so proactive in the crypto space, and their first thing was like to build their own version of a sort of fusion tool that they could take the best of all of the data, plus the intelligence that they had, and plus the stuff that they could never share, and from their covert work and everything, and basically build this engine. So please do. We're love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that data fusion concept is less about the technology and more about the partnerships and the data that's being shared, but we can come back to some of the technology points in a bit. So this was based on initially a small pilot with a couple of UK banks, and I should say this is one of the lessons, I think, is often starting small is best you know, with trusted partners, and then you build out, learn, and then can grow from that. But I started with two UK banks. It then evolved to seven. And the sort of latest iteration, which is live at the moment, is eight UK banks. And basically what they're doing is they're sharing transaction data, or a subset of transaction data that relates to sort of higher risk customer segments. So, you know, for example, cash rich businesses may be considered slightly higher risk. And so it's data related to them that might be shared. As you say, there are different themes that are used, so depending on what the theme is, will dictate what some of the data is that's shared. That data comes into the NEC, and it's then washed against the SARS data. So this is where there's then the partnership with the UKFIU, but also data from Action Fraud. So for those who don't know, that's the victim data that comes into City of London Police. You know, if you've been defrauded, you can report it through a central portal. So we get that Action Fraud data. And then there's all the other crime data sets, and also other potentially sort of OSINT data sets that the NCA holds. The other sort of big shift in this initiative is this data isn't just analysed by NCA and UKFIU officers. We also have personnel from the banks who've been vetted and become what are called NCA specials. They sit in a joint analytical team. So you have bank staff alongside NCA and UKFIU staff. And so they're all bringing their own areas of expertise and knowledge together. And also, to an extent, they're, as appropriate, coming back to the tooling point. So trying to use the various capabilities they've got to make best use of the data. And the result of this, certainly the last pilot we ran with the seven banks, we generated over 300 intelligence packages that went out. Six new investigations or enforcement investigations were established. A lot of the current investigations were enriched in terms of the understanding of the criminals that were being investigated. Some, I think, opened up new investigative avenues for the senior investigating officers. Also, and this is coming back to the point about the one-way traffic, strategic intelligence went back to the banks. So you know, things like typologies, sort of profiles that the analysis had identified were indicative of
sort of blind spots that they may have and not be aware of.
Yeah. Went back to the banks. And as I understand it, at least two of the banks amended the transaction monitoring regimes as a result, which is not a straightforward thing to do. So what you got was that two-way flow, which is so pretty unusual. So that now has been put on a more permanent footing. Those were pilots. This is now has moved into BAU. And as I say, it involves eight banks. And yeah, there's a lot of ongoing discussion about and where next with data fusion. Yeah, there's a recognition that with eight UK banks, it's covering a very significant proportion of the sort of UK banking landscape. But then if you get into wider payments institutions, you know, there's lots of other players. And so question mark, how do you bring them into play? There's also, and you've touched on it, there's crypto. You know, does that come into the mix? And then you've got the whole cross-sector piece. So what about the tech sector, et cetera? So you know, there's a long way to go to really build this out to be some fully comprehensive thing. But to have got where it's got to, you know, it's been hard yards over a number of years.
I was going to say, it sounds like a pretty promising start. And I know that, I mean, the whole point of this podcast is, you know, we will have people in different jurisdictions. We will have the, you know, national AML coordinators who are, you know, preparing for future mutual evaluations with FATF, and they're thinking, what can we do? Like, what systems can we build? What initiatives can we drive to try and tackle the specific threats that have been identified as a result of their national risk assessment, for example? And I think that, I mean, you'd mentioned the success around being sort of like, you know, small pilots. And I think that most people forget, I mean, when they hear the word, you know, the bank working with the government, they forget that quite often a lot of this is, you know, small, localized, personality driven, where you do have, you know, the, you know, trust being the key word, trusted partners. You're not talking about some faceless banker. You're talking about someone that was probably a colleague that has joined the bank, who understands what you're trying to achieve and understands the actual gaps. I mean, I've been to the Gimlet, and I've sat in sort of similar meetings, and it's basically, you know, the former heads and former sort of senior officers of a lot of these law enforcement agencies. And we also see the same in crypto, where we see the former heads and leads at FIUs now taking up senior positions. So I'm sure that sort of helps things, because you've you know, the majority of time you'll have reasonable, sensible people knowing that they just can't ask for the moon. Similarly, there's a mutual respect there and a bit of trust that, you know, we, and mission-driven people. Do you find that, and I know you'd sort of commented on this sort of post the sort of Cambridge event, like sticking with that thread of you've built a model framework and you're now realizing, and sort of to quote you, you know, you've got, and I completely agree for the avoidance of doubt, this global fragmentation where you now have the creation of entirely parallel financial systems, and you have things like stable coins that may not be hitting, I mean, the rails. If you were still in your old role and you were planning for the next 2 to 3 years, what would you be guessing? And I appreciate this is not speaking about the neck or your former employer, but what would you think if you were sitting in similar positions in another country around the world? How can people start to think about, like, how do we even, like, consider dealing with the potential risks of illicit financial flows with VASPs, bad VASPs, and then things like sort of stable coins?
Again, I mean, there's a huge...
I appreciate it. It's a small question.
and sort of as I was saying, we still haven't really mastered the domestic yet. Yeah. So this is where it's really tricky, because...
Tricky, yeah.
How much do we focus on the international when clearly it's a massive part of the challenge? As mm-hmm. we know, this is a global problem. But you've got to sort of, you know, you've got to be careful not biting off more than you can chew. And so certainly when I was director of the NEC, I was, yes, looking at the international where I could, but again, more bite-sized chunks. My yeah. primary focus was getting the domestic right. So, yeah. you know, and there's still a long way to go in that. And
the actual local harm that's being caused.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had sort of various thoughts as to what we needed to do more of domestically. And I can sort of take you through that if that would be helpful at some point. But in terms of that also recognizing the international challenge, just to give you a few examples Please. Of the sorts of work we were doing in the NEC in that arena, but, you know, say there's a huge amount more to do. We developed, and I don't think I'm able to name the country, but at this stage we looked at an operational partnership with a particular country, and whether we could better share SARS data, because, you know, at the moment one of the problems is that an international bank will potentially be able to see the challenges and the issues going on in one country and a second country, but when they report it through sort of SARS, they have to disaggregate that information mm-hmm. and send the country the information relevant to one country to the relevant FIU and up a totally different channel to the other FIU. And that information may never meet. So the bank can see it, but law enforcement in those countries can't.
And they lose that important context.
Yeah. So we piloted using various glossary codes to basically say, if this bank has reported this to the UK FIU and used this glossary code, then there is information of direct relevance sat with another FIU. And so it triggered an immediate request for the sort of the related information, and vice versa coming from the other country. So, I mean, it sounds really clunky, but and it was, but that's an example of sort of trying to work out how you can start to get data flowing more easily across borders. And as we know, even within these banks themselves, there's some significant challenges in sharing data related to different countries within which they operate. You know, that's not an entirely straightforward process within a bank, let alone getting it flowing across international boundaries at the law enforcement levels. So anyway, so we've had a go at that. I think that will continue to evolve. So recognising fraud, and we'll talk about some of UK fraud, so some kind of overseas component, recognising that remains a big challenge. We worked closely with key operational partners internationally. So, you know, I was in places like India, Ghana, Nigeria, and, you know, we were developing, continue to develop ways of operational working with them. That involves intelligence sharing, often involving the US as well. So, you know, there are initiatives going on, but, you know, the reality is they are still relatively piecemeal, and they're not, you know, systemic international solutions. And I've been really interested in the work that Nick Maxwell at RUSI has been leading. I don't know whether you've come across it, Aidan, but so he's looking at a number of different approaches to how you improve global intelligence sharing. And you know, I'm really supportive of the sort of the initiative he's driving, because, like, again, he's focused on this almost piloting different types of ways of doing intelligence sharing. And I think that's what we're going to have to do, is keep piloting, keep trying stuff, yeah. learn by doing, based on trust. And then if we can prove a model or approach works, then you can start to expand it out more widely.
And what do you think then, to take it back to the, because I completely agree in the sense of sometimes it's very easy for people to not be realistic about the scale of the challenge. And we just think, right, we should solve this thing and then solve this thing here. And then, as you mentioned, like domestically, we often give the example that if you have all of these challenges in asset recovery and then you overlay crypto assets, then you overlay stable coins, then you overlay, there's so many additional threats that can go on. It can just seem sort of overwhelming. I mean, how do you balance that politically? Because I can imagine there's a lot of, you know, the phrase that was used a lot, that the last couple of events at, you know, Cambridge and Wilted Park, Illicit Finance Summit, and there's been so many events, and the term political will, you know, gets sort of kicked around a lot. In your sort of previous role as well, I mean, how does anybody in a senior law enforcement position, you know, do that really difficult sort of dance of tackling what is the domestic things that are in front of you, but acknowledging a country's role in international, I mean, cooperation, and knowing that most agencies don't have the budget that they want or the resources that they want? I mean, how did you sort of get that balance, and what do you think were some of the biggest domestic challenges that the UK continues to face?
Again, there's a lot in that question, so I might only answer part of it and bring it back. I haven't answered properly.
I get more ideas as I talk along. It's proof this isn't scripted.
But I mean, being the neck being held in the NCA was a significant advantage in terms of international work, because the NCA has its network of liaison officers across the globe. I can't remember what the exact number is, but, you know, 150 odd.
Yeah, a lot.
across the world. So you can immediately work through them to partner with the range of countries we'd want to work with. I'd also say, and I'm perhaps bouncing around a bit in response to your question, but on the you've talked about digital assets and crypto quite a lot, and actually I think I would argue that the digital asset space gives us opportunities we don't have in this sort of traditional sort of fiat space, you know, in some of the thinking I've set out about what we need to do differently, I'll give you the spiel very quickly, and you can sort of pick away at this if you want to. I talk about four aims and three shifts that we've got to be really focused on. So the four aims, the key one is real time intervention, because the reality is, if we don't get on it up front, it'll go and it'll be very hard to get it back. So real time intervention is really key. If you can't intervene in real time, is then about recovery. You know, how can we improve our ability to get the assets, etc., back? The third aim is clearly disruption. You know, we need to be disrupting this stuff, and law enforcement have a key role to play there. But it isn't just criminal justice outcomes; there are other ways of disrupting. And then the last key aim, and these all sort of flow between each other, is prevention. And obviously, prevention is how you hopefully, you know, improve control environments and stop the stuff happening even in the first place. So, intervention, recovery, disruption, and prevention. Those are the four core aims. And in particular, I think we need to do more in the real-time intervention space. And then in terms of the shifts, the way I look at it is you've got sort of a payments, digital assets shift in the middle, and I'll come back to that. But then you've got, what more do we need to do with illicit finance? And this is where we talk about, in my view, we look at things like data fusion, we look at SARS, and ultimately with SARS, we should... Again, my personal view, we should be thinking about less volume, higher quality. And ultimately using that data to drive out better quality intelligence for collective action, whether it be law enforcement or improvement of controls. And then with fraud, it's a similar sort of thing, albeit it's even more cross-sector. You have to involve the tech sector and the telco sector in a way we don't currently. But say between the fraud and the illicit finance work, you've then got payments that sort of sit in the middle. And as I say, we need to be moving to real-time intervention in payment space. And actually, real-time intervention is happening already in crypto. Yeah. So whether it's the likes of Beacon, which is something which a company I'm advising, TRM, have recently launched with a range of partners, or it's, again, T3, which, again, TRM are involved in. And clearly, other companies are also doing things like this. But mm-hmm. These are initiatives which are driving at through information sharing, data sharing between the various bits of the digital assets ecosystem, including law enforcement, to try and stop the assets moving, or if they have started to move, trace them and then sort of freeze them, seize them somewhere else. So it is possible in the digital asset ecosystem in a way it isn't with fiat, because you have the transparency of the blockchain. In fiat, you know, once the cash is gone, it is really hard to trace it. That's where I think there's a separate set of challenges domestically, let alone internationally, with the way payments data is shared in the UK or not in reality. And there's a whole sort of chunk of work I think we need to do in the UK around our payments data.
Even data sharing from a digital assets point of view, because you're sharing blockchain, no data, there's a lot of arguments that actually a lot of it falls into public domain before you get into the real weeds of attribution. But you know, we're in complete agreement. I often talk about the fact that, I mean, digital asset recovery, all of the infrastructure is in place to actually be much more effective in terms of tracing, attribution, recovery. You know, stable coins, the ability to actually burn and reissue, like that's the only equivalent I've ever seen of that is the manual equivalent of that, as I remember the Northern Bank robbery in Belfast, when they physically just knew the bank after they'd lost, it was 15 million, 20 million, just literally ceased those banknotes and said, in a week's time, we're issuing a new banknote. Like that banknote will be invalid going forward. And that was one of the biggest, I think it's been done a couple of times before globally. Whereas with stablecoins, you can, you know, there is the art of the possible in stablecoins, that every time you see something bad, you could just stop it, potentially. I'm in complete agreement with that. There is those possibilities. Yeah, you'd also mentioned then. Did you want to unpack that? What we have to do domestically?
Well, that's a drawing on what I've just said. I think there's a number of areas of improvement that we could really push on in the UK. And then some of this is already happening. So it was announced, I think, at the 10-year anniversary for the NEC, for Gimlet, a few months ago, by Steve Smart, who's the DG of Enforcement at the FCA. But there's something called system prioritization that's been launched. And the NEC, again, working with partners, have set 9 priorities for, in particular, the banks, but by extension, potentially, over time, because it's still a pilot, with the wider regulated sector. Because this is a recognition that, you know, this is a massive problem area. As we know, billions is spent on compliance, but it still isn't really focusing on the things that are necessarily making the biggest difference. And so what we're trying in the UK is to, through the NEC, set some clearer sort of operational priorities, which the banks can then focus greater resource on, albeit this is primarily voluntary effort. And then perhaps where there's a lot of effort going in, but it's nugatory, or it's having less impact on the threat, they can, for want of a better term, dial down some of their effort in that space. Yeah. So dial up, dial down is the shorthand for this. But what it's really seeking to do is to enable the public sector, the government, to work with the huge amount of capacity and capability that sits out in the private sector to harness all that effort and get it to where it really is going to make a difference, and move beyond, and I'm caricaturing here, but move beyond the sort of tick box checklist type of approach to compliance, which doesn't necessarily actually impact on the threat. And I think the fact that we had Steve Smart, the DG of Enforcement at the FCA, publicly announcing this shows that the FCA are, you know, integrally involved in this ambition.
It's a big stakeholder signal.
They're co-chairs of the relevant board that's going to oversee the work that goes on against these priorities. So this for me is a big shift. And it basically was my key ambition when I started at the NEC was, you know, I've come out of the private sector. I can see all the capacity and capability that sits in the private sector. Now, if we don't harness that in government, it's a massive missed opportunity. Mm-hmm. So for me, system prioritization is a big thing. You know, it's not easy to get it right, but it's absolutely the right thing to try and do, you know, to target our collective efforts, you know, where it'll have greatest impact.
And does that feed in then to your sort of, you know, quality, not quantity, to have that clarity on the banking side, for example, as to what is the priority? Because we see this with VASPs and neobanks and others coming on, where there is the technology now, and I know we'll talk about AI in a bit, but there is the technology now to just machine gun SARS out the door, and we're seeing smaller jurisdictions being absolutely overwhelmed. Does issuing that clarity, thinking about how other countries can borrow from this playbook, having that sort of prioritization and that publication of clear information, is that the intention? Is that, you know, the banks ultimately know, they know what's important to you? And that's what you mean by the dial up, dial down.
I mean, certainly what we're after ultimately is quality intelligence coming in to law enforcement. So law enforcement can focus its, what will always be, limited resource on the places where it will have greatest impact. And similarly, actually, when we're looking at the banks and the private sector's own resources, you know, we want them to be orientated towards where the threat seems to be greatest. And if there's changes in control environment that can make a difference, you know, that should be where we think the bigger threats are. So yes, for me, ultimately, this is about quality over quantity. And in some ways, it's almost strange timing that just as we're starting to build the technology capabilities that can deal with, you know, large scale data, we're almost sort of saying we don't necessarily want so much of it. But I think there's a nuance there. So taking data fusion as an example, you know, there's a lot of data coming in, but it's still data which we've done a lot of work together on to determine that's the data we want. We don't want everything. You know, we want certain refined sources of data because we think that's where the risk is highest. So I think there is a sweet spot between saying, you know, it's high quality, lower volume, but also take advantage of the technology opportunities that we have with data and AI, etc. You know, there is a sweet spot between the two. So it's not just about being overwhelmed by a load of data. We get the right data and we work it with the right tools to then target our collective efforts, you know, where we're going to have biggest impact.
And on the AI point, you'd followed up after the symposium, but talking about, I mean, everyone mentions AI, we hear it everywhere all the time, and you'd mentioned sort of moving beyond hype to delivery. I mean, what does that mean for you? What would you expect to see as the tools in terms of implementation, or again, with your old hat on, what would you be looking for over the next couple of years?
It's really interesting for me because at the moment I'm looking at it from the perspective of having come out of some digital transformation work that's happening in the UKFIE, and we're looking at lots of different tooling, through to now talking to a range of companies in the private sector who are really trying to exploit the new capabilities that are coming on stream. But the reality is when you actually try and land this stuff, it's really hard. And you know, people claim it's AI when it isn't really AI, or you know, it is AI, but my goodness, are there some challenges with using AI? You know, everyone's aware of the sort of hallucination risk, etc. You know, these things aren't easy. So, you know, I've really enjoyed actually some of the companies I'm now advising actually really getting below the bonnet and seeing them as they're trying to build these capabilities and seeing them try to overcome the challenges that there are. And I am confident, you know, we will get there. So, you know, I suppose if I was to say what my profession is, albeit I've bounced around lots of different jobs over the years, you know, at heart I'm an intelligence officer. And just looking at what some of the agentic AI tooling will be able to do, if not today, you know, certainly tomorrow, you know, it's massive what the capabilities are that are coming down the track in terms of ability to, you know, process those large amounts of data more effectively, you know, operate 24/7, and deliver a far more honed product at the end of it, which again, and this is all comes back to the same point really, which is we need to use our tooling and our intelligence and partnership to target our efforts where it's going to have greatest impact. And I think, you know, AI tooling, when we get it right, will enable us to do that. But there, you know, it's a lot of hard work to go before we get there.
And where do you think that then fits into the impact that could have on asset recovery? If we're talking about, you know, the FATF focus on asset recovery, we're seeing this trickle down into the EU, the creation of, you know, asset management offices, and one of the EU mandated requirements is you must have a centralized register of all of your seized assets. There's this accountability coming in. Do you see a role that AI will play in terms of tooling in the sort of trying to fix asset recovery, or is it, do you think it'll be more concentrated on the, as you mentioned, you know, the role in sort of financial intelligence, building better, higher quality cases, opportunities for intervention? Do you see it more at that early stage, or do you think, or do you have thoughts on how it's going to affect sort of everything?
I sort of think they're interrelated, because you know, some of the investigative ambitions are, yes, you want to identify the criminals behind the criminality, but also you want to identify the assets that either they've stolen from people as part of their criminality, or that they've then used the laundered, you know, money that they've acquired to purchase. And so I think the AI tooling will help you do both, you know, better identify the criminals themselves, but also the assets either that they've taken or that they're then acquiring through their criminality. And so if you can better identify that those assets domestically, but certainly this is where you get back to the international point, if we can better identify it internationally, then there's more opportunity to be seized and recover those assets. And this certainly sort of touching on some of the, you know, the things that I was pondering post the, you talked about the Cambridge Symposium. Again, for those who aren't aware, there was an international sort of conference that's hosted in Cambridge every year in September, and we were both at it. And I was doing some sort of thinking while I was there and on my way away from it. And you know, there's no doubt we have some significant challenges with asset recovery work domestically, but certainly internationally. You know, so what can we do differently to get us in a better place? And there's always the stats about the scale of the illicit finance challenge globally, and then the tiny proportion of the assets that we then are able to ultimately recover. So yeah, I think we all are fighting with this issue of what can we do differently. And obviously, Aidan, the work you're doing with Asset Reality is sort of at the heart of some of those sort of ambitions to do things differently. But for me, you know, we've touched on some of it around digital assets and the opportunities that there are to use sort of technologies and partnerships to better identify and hopefully recover those assets. I think there is something in the space of how can we, again, bring the private sector capabilities to bear in a way we don't currently. I suppose that now I've left government, people say it's only because you left government you're starting to say this, but I was trying to work out how we do it when I was in government, which is, you know, is there an opportunity to use some of the resources from the recovered assets to then fund more private sector effort in the space to then recover more assets and get a flywheel going. So, you know, you're bringing in more of those assets, which fund the private sector sort of resourcing side of it, but clearly also get money back to the victims, fund the law enforcement response. And actually, there was one of the presentations at the symposium, which was talking about using recovered assets to finance community projects. Yeah. That was a really good example. I think it was in West Yorkshire, where there's a sort of community hub that's been established, paid for from recovered assets. So
literally why we exist. Yeah. And that is something that's done around the world quite well. It was sort of forcibly done by the Italians with the anti-mafia legislation, because they had properties that no one would buy because of intimidation, and they started reusing them for things. So I'm a big fan of responsible social reuse. But if I can just go back, I just wanted to take you back a second to clarify something, because a lot of guests, and we hear, you know, a lot in the sector, talk about, you know, public-private sector collaboration, bringing in the private sector. What do you mean when you say private, like in a magic wand? I mean, what for you would be the epitome of good private sector involvement? Because I know that if I'm sitting with caseworkers, they're thinking that, you know, someone like an insolvency practitioner working on a proceeds of crime case, using civil recovery powers and taking the whole case from cradle to grave. For other private sector is, you know, leveraging the data and the intelligence and the resources they have. What does private sector involvement mean for you?
It's potentially all of the above.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, clearly any private sector activity has to be directed appropriately by law enforcement or government. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we can just sort of let the private sector run free. Yeah. I can say run wild, that's probably unfair. But you know, there needs to be some kind of oversight. And I often had these conversations with sort of the NCA legal team, which was how much, you know, could they harness the private sector legal capacity and capability to support their work? And they were very much up for doing that. But they were very clear that, you know, you had to have an NCA legal officer sort of directing that casework.
Absolutely.
And so it'll always need to be a partnership piece to this. I don't think you say you can just leave private sector to it itself. But that being said, the private sector, especially as with these new capabilities, AI, et cetera, are harnessed, the private sector can almost get to a point where the case is, if not on a plate, you know, it's very well served up, which just then makes it easier for law enforcement, CPS and others to then take it the final few steps. So it just feels like we're not yet harnessing the capacity capabilities of the private sector in a way that ideally we would do. So this isn't easy. In the UK, mm-hmm. we have this ARIS asset recovery incentivization scheme, which is used to return funds to law enforcement once the victims have been reimbursed, to help law enforcement then do what they need to do. And even that's quite complicated when you've got more than one force who's involved, police force involved.
How do you divvy them?
Yes, what proportion, etc. So if you then start to bring the private sector into that mix, that gets even more complicated. So yeah, this is not easy, and there'll need to be quite a lot of work to try and determine how best to do it. But certainly, in my new guise, hopefully I can sort of bring some of the private sector perspective to bear in conversation with colleagues or former colleagues in government, etc., just to see, can we come up with some cunning ideas, possibly pilots, for how we might be able to do this better in future. Mm. And then it's an additional point, but I think it's sort of interlinked. The one of the other fundamental challenges we have is the speed of legal process alongside the speed of sort of intelligence data sharing process. And I think, as we all know, the sort of MLAP processes, the mutual sort of legal assistance process, these are very slow and cumbersome internationally. Yeah. We've got more work to do as a system to try and determine how can we speed up those processes to get them. I mean, they're never going to keep up with the speed of money flows, etc. But then there needs to be a better way of doing the sort of evidence sharing across borders to enable us to take quicker action from a sort of court legal perspective. Because at the moment, we can seize relatively easily, or certainly freeze, but actually recovering is very, very hard and takes a lot longer. And so there's something about how we improve those processes internationally as well.
So that is a good point for us to conclude on, in the sense of your magic wand question. You've laid out really articulately what the different challenges are, and I've really enjoyed your perspective, because we haven't had as many people on the podcast that have that variation that you've had in your career, and getting to have those sort of unique perspectives. Given the fact that we can't fix everything, as much as we would all like to, and we would all like better asset recovery and better asset seizure and more information flowing in, and the better flywheel and better community reinvestment, which ticks on your sort of your prevention and then the disruption, taking assets, taking the capital out of criminality. If there was, you had to lay the chips down and say, okay, we can only really make a dent in one of these things, or the Plato's the 80-20 rule. Where would you be if you're sitting now in this sort of global advisory? I wouldn't put you as the head of FADI I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But if you had that ability to say, right, I'm now going to steer things, what do you think information sharing, accountability, what the private sector, what would you say is if there was one thing we could move the needle on, what would get your vote?
I think it has to be information sharing across border.
Yeah,
because that ultimately drives then all the follow-up action. As we all know, that there remain significant challenges in how we do that, but that has to be the central driver, because through that information, that intelligence, then you can take action. If you haven't shared the information in the first place, you're not going to...
There won't be asset recovery unless there is the intel to actually go after it in the first place.
So that has to be the first step. No. And I just realized that one thing we haven't touched on, which you did raise a couple of times, and I didn't spark on, was... The reality for all of us, though, is this is going to get ever harder as we have fragmentation of the global financial system, and as we have a sort of East and West sort of models developing, and information sharing gets even harder because of some of the rivalries and tension.
Throw in multiple crypto regulatory regimes as well.
So, but as a minimum, though, I'm simplifying.
Just geopolitics.
But the Western half of this, we've got to at least get it right in that space. And we haven't even got it right there, so that's got to be a focus.
Perfect. Well, listen, Adrian, thank you so much for your insights. I'm sure we'll get a bunch of questions, and I'd love to do a follow-up sort of this time next year when you're sort of in, because what we see is more and more this requirement from countries for a better playbook to try and tackle this problem. And I think that at least having a better focus on asset recovery and the accountability and the end result might drive some of these things. But certainly for me, the last six or seven events that I've been at or been involved in, unanimously information sharing, faster information sharing, you know, keeps coming out on top. So we will watch this space and see if things change. But thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I know you've got multiple hats that you're now wearing in the private sector, a man in demand. And thanks for sharing your insights with us today.
It's a real pleasure joining you, Aidan.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.